Hello and welcome to Noise and the Megacity. If you've joined us on previous programs, you will have heard my discussions about noise, about what we mean when we call a sound noise. I won't rehash all of those arguments and questions and conversations right now, but in order to distill all of these ideas into one pithy little phrase, by calling sound a noise, by calling a person noisy, we say, among other things, I don't care for it. I don't like it, yes, but I'm not going to like it. I'm not going to take the time. So all of that goes into, I simply do not care for that sound. And for me, that begs the question, what would caring for a sound be like? What kind of listening practice might we cultivate to care for the sounds and the people who we perhaps unthinkingly designate as noisy? So today on the program, I'm diving back into a different archive than I tend to tap into. This time I'm going back to my recorded interviews from a show that I did at WOBC in Oberlin while I was at college. For that show, I interviewed composers mainly and sound artists. And I simply asked, what is your practice of listening? I had not really arrived at this interest in noise specifically at that point. But now looking back on the kinds of questions I was asking and the things that I was given by the interviewees, I think it's quite relevant to this question of what would it mean or how could we care for a sound that we may perceive initially to be noisy. I think composers and sound artists have a particularly good understanding of the sound world, because they often use those very sounds that we consider, at best, byproducts. You know, the slamming of a door, the tinkle of a teaspoon in a teacup. Any of these things could be fodder for a sound art composition. And thus, I've asked these composers what their relationship to sound is. And through that, maybe we may better understand what noise is, and how to perhaps liberate it from those subjective definitions. Enjoy.
This is composer Eleni Lilios, and you are listening to Organized Noise. When I'm thinking that I'm going to compose a new piece, I really start tuning in to the environment around me. I try to listen all the time to all sounds. And I have some training in deep listening, which is a whole body sound practice that was developed by Pauline Oliveros. Deep listening helped me think more purposely about the sound I was listening to. Am I listening to a specific sound? Am I listening to all sound that's happening around me all the time? And it gave me a number of tools and tricks to use to refine my listening. So I simply experience the sound world that exists around me, and when I find something that intrigues me, I explore it. Could be the door of a dishwasher that is very squeaky, or it could be strings of bells. These sort of things that people don't normally think about as necessarily being musical, like the dishwasher, or some creaky door, or some motor that makes a funky sound. The process of working with sound for me is the process of learning about that sound and discovering its sonic potential as a musical instrument, where that word instrument has quotes around it. I mean that in a very loose way. I became entranced with sound as a young girl when I was 5 years old. I received a transistor radio as a birthday gift. And I used to ride around on my bicycle with the transistor radio pressed up to my ear so I could listen to the radio day and night. As I became older, my girlfriend down the street was playing organ. And I think that's where the experimentalism came in. She could play low bass notes on the pedals, and there were all these little buttons and levers and knobs that she could press that made the sound of the organ change. And I was really fascinated by that as a young girl. And I ended up taking organ lessons, and that was my introduction to music. The problem with critique is that sometimes you can't identify the why of something. Why something works, why something doesn't work. And I think that's a challenge, especially if when you're working with yourself, you can say to yourself, you know, this just isn't quite working. I'm not sure why, but I know it doesn't work. So I'm going to keep finagling it. I'm going to change it. I'm going to do something to it so that I can see if I can make it better. But when you have to articulate that to a collaborator or articulate perhaps to a student, and you can't exactly explain why. So sometimes I can identify why. It slows down too much here. This sound is looping too long. There's not enough activity here. You're not pushing to the climax with enough energy. So sometimes it's very easy to articulate the weaknesses, and then sometimes you just have to say, you know, there's nothing wrong with what you're doing, but it's just lacking some magic dust, as odd as it sounds. There's something extra that is somehow unexplainable, I think, that's not quantifiable about what we do. That's the magic dust part. There are some things about what we do as composers that cannot be explained. You know, where do you get your inspiration? Well, I can kind of talk about that, but in a certain way, I can't really tell you, because at the end of the day, I'm not sure. You know, there are certain questions that we just can't answer. Unless the activity of composition for us is a wholly, somehow scientific or wholly process-based, which for me it isn't.
I can definitely, very boring.
This is one of the beauties of the fact that we're all so different as composers. We all have different interests. We have different things that are important to us. So the people who are the algorithmic people who like to write computer programs or who like to create processes of some sort, some device, that generates either a musical idea or musical material or some element of music for them, to be creative in a way that makes sense to them. There's no one right way to do anything. There's no best way. It's whatever way everyone discovers for themselves and for the people who like it. I'm really happy to look at this computer program that you develop that generates all of this musical material. But for me as a composer, at the end of the day, I'm going to admire it, and I'm going to say that's awesome. But I really want to hear the music that you're making with me.
I'm Peter Swenson, and you're listening to Organized Noise. Well, I grew up in a pretty rural part of northeastern Pennsylvania, so I wasn't around big nature a lot growing up. You know, there aren't huge mountains or intimidating landscapes, but I was just outside a lot. You know, so that was all through growing up and in high school, and then I came to Oberlin to do my undergraduate degree, and Oberlin is even less of a big outdoorsy place than Pennsylvania is in terms of landscape. So it was really then when I left Oberlin and went to California that I was confronted with what for me was really new and exciting, which were big landscapes, big mountains, the Pacific Ocean.
Huge.
Different animals, lots of snow. You know, everything really was just bigger. And the more time I spent exploring California, I was living in the Bay Area, going to Mills College. And I think that's what really cemented my love for those places was the time out west. The one thing that I missed a lot in California were the seasons. And it was then that I realized that not only was nature evocative for me in terms of like places where you spend time, landscapes and stuff, but also how time is measured through a day or a week or a year. And California was really weird because like the weather would be the same for a long time. And that totally threw me off. The seasons themselves have a lot contained within them, but when I really notice them is when they start to change, right? Like right now, outside, is when you really all of a sudden are very aware of the season. You're remembering all these things that you've taken for granted from the last few months about temperature and humidity and things that you just kind of got used to. And then you're looking forward to, or not, you know, the what's about to come in terms of colder weather and shorter days and things like that. So those points of change in the year have always kind of fascinated me because it's these collisions of very big forces that have an immediate and visceral impact on how you exist in the world. And I was interested in finding a place that had amazing and varied nature within some kind of proximity to studios, just practically speaking, where I could do work, but also to find a place that had a social or a cultural engagement with that nature that would lead people to be out in it doing stuff, right? I was kind of curious to see not just the mountains, but like who is out in the mountains. Even though my work, I wouldn't say, has a lot to do with like social issues per se, but there are elements of society present in some of it.
Wow.
what I learned on the very first sort of field recording trip that I did when I lived in Norway was that I had a couple things sort of wrong in my head. So I went there, I'd written this Fulbright proposal, which was, you know, a long process, like more than a year out ahead of time. And I went with the intention of gathering a lot of sounds, basically. I mean, there was more to it than that, but, you know, I had what was at the time one of the newer, you know, flash media field recorders. Finally, we were over, like, portable DAT recorders and stuff like that. So I was all excited about that. I had all this new gear. I had written this proposal. My wife and I had, you know, left where we were living, moved across the Atlantic. All of this stuff had kind of happened over a long period of time. And then the first real, like, trip specifically to gather sounds, we took a few weeks after we got there. And we left Oslo and we drove up past Lillehammer, where they had the Olympics in 1994, and up into kind of central Norway. It's not all the way north, like really central, but it's thought of as central Norway, to the Rondane National Park, which is this beautiful, huge, vast national park, mostly above the tree line. So you drive up from the highway, which is not a big superhighway, but already kind of a small road, and you drive up to this plateau where the park is. And then you can only get so far in with the car, and then you have to bike or hike or do whatever. And they have these great trails and hut systems and everything. So it was quite a, you know, production. And I had all this gear with me, and we had the tent and, yeah, sleeping bags and all this stuff. And so we leave the car and we go into the, you know, towards the center of this park. And we got there very late at night, and we found where we were going. We set up the tent, and I got up early the next morning because it was still getting light out really early. This is like August. And it felt like, okay, this is literally the start of this project, right? Like, it's been going for a year now with the application and moving here and everything. And now, like, this morning is when it begins, you know, and I'm going to start collecting all these sounds. So I, like, it was pretty cold, so I kind of, like, warmed up all the equipment in the tent, and then I hiked up part of the way up this hill/mountain on the side of this fjord, lake, really. It's inland, so it's not really a fjord, but feels sort of fjord-like, and got all my stuff set up, and it was, like, this beautiful, stunning landscape, and I was like, yes, this is, like, it just literally felt like if I was making the movie of the project, this is where it would begin. So I get everything set, and I press record, and then I realized that there's really no sound happening, right? We're, like, above the tree line. It's early in the morning. There are a few kind of birds a little bit here and there. It was, like, really distant, maybe waterfall, something like that. But it's really quiet and beautifully quiet. And it was like a light bulb went off that, sure, I would probably gather a lot of sounds during the year, but what was more important, I realized at that point, was taking note of those experiences. You find yourself in this place, and it's a specific and unique situation with weather and landscape and, you know, just personal mood and how you got there and who you're with and all of these things that have much more hard to define and impossible to capture parameters. You can't, you know, turn on the recorder and get that stuff. And it was a really significant moment for me. And so, you know, I went on to get lots of great recordings, but many of the pieces that came as a result of my time in Norway don't actually maybe use any field recordings. Or if they do, it's only a few, or they draw on recordings from different places. But the experiences of being in those places at those times of year is what I then tried to really capture and recreate through the music.
Hi, this is Christy Laurenti. You're listening to Organized Noise. I began making field recordings in the early 1990s, and like most young artists, I started out by making the work of others, other artists. I admired and still do admire the work of Bernie Krause and Gordon Hempton, but like a lot of young artists, my work began in revolt, and it began in revolt against almost everything I had heard before, especially the radio. So I began making field recordings, and I would wander off out into the woods, and I'd go into the fields, valleys, wherever there was supposedly nature, and found that my recordings were just kind of sickly, generic imitations of other artists. And then I found my own forest, and my own forest is actually where I'm from, which is the city, city street. And making recordings of people talking and interacting and gathering and living life. That to me is a rich soundscape, still in many ways what R. Murray Schafer would call a lo-fi soundscape. But to me, that was the environment that I could make field recordings in, that I could find myself as an artist, and the most importantly, where I really learned to listen. Well, for me, and I'm speaking only about myself here, is that the two most important skills a composer can have are amnesia and empathy. Amnesia is absolutely crucial because you are listening to whatever, the composer listens to what she or he has made, and there's a tendency to fall in love with it. You get to know it. You know the interstitial relationships. You become intimate with the work. And if you keep spending time with it and you feel it is worth your time, there is an attachment that takes hold. But this is where empathy comes in. So for me, I try, when I make a field recording, when I go out and listen, I am listening myself. But when I then make the decision to share that work or whatever emerges from that work I did with the world, when I decide to share it with the world, then I think empathy is absolutely crucial. Tristan Mirai makes this wonderful point in an essay that as composers, we are asking our listeners for a sacrifice. And that sacrifice is one of time and of mortality.
Here is yet another take of Anthem.
For me, the field recording is a way I share the memory of what I recorded. So when things are EQ'd or edited, I'm never presenting objective fact. And all of my works have obvious, almost all of my works have very obvious edits. And that's deliberate. That's to serve as a rhetorical reminder that you are listening to something that is constructed, right? Most of our world is made rather than merely exists. So when you hear this piece, this obvious construct, I still hope it reaches people. And I construct it in a way that is close to my own memory of the piece as possible. Not actually what happened, but it's close to how I remember what happened and what I would like to remember happened.
Again, quickly caused partial lockdown. 8th and Seneca, they're trying to erect some sort of a barricade there.
Get it out.
Received an information from the demo desk. The protesters at 7 and Stewart are setting up the
intersection. Trying to secure themselves like a manhole cover out here on the street.
Okay, again, the front loader up to 8th and Seneca, and it looks like they're trying to secure themselves to the manhole covers.
Listening by denying the visual element actually allows us to penetrate class-based assumptions. It allows us, I believe, to see power structures a bit more clearly. And I also think that it connects us closer to who we are with. To me, the power of field recording rests not in the act of recording, but it resides in the act of repetition, of return, of going back and teasing out and hearing what really happened. And for those who were there, it might not even be really necessary. And I don't think any recording, audio or video, can replace or supplant the camaraderie that folks felt, say, at Occupy Wall Street or the 2004 protest against the Republican National Convention in New York, or any of the other hundreds of these kinds of these gatherings. But I do think it's very important, and I do think it's a way, at least from a journalistic standpoint, to threaten accountability. And it also serves as a visual act to threaten those in authority that we will remember, or at least there is the potential, the possibility of people remembering.
What follows is air traffic recorded on November 30th, 1999. This recording will commence with air traffic at 06:17 hours and 16 seconds.
Squad 31, follow me, car A, Adam.
562-56. They're going to report to state and county, going to report directly to us, is that correct?
The buses?
Yes.
The service is happy.
Metro and everything's getting ready. They got a bunch of tow trucks and everything ready here.
Psalm 66 on command 3.
At 232, what were the purpose of those Metro buses? What were they for?
There's two suspects, one wearing a red hooded sweatshirt.
Psalm 5 and 332, I don't know. I assume it would be for something having to do with
the suspects. They walked past the monsters a few minutes.
Apparently he's got some buses.
Some pipes underneath their
door to put them, and I know nothing about it.
Radio to 703.
232.
Radio
to
705, Lucy, do you think the buses are for you?
That's correct. We've got 15 extra people that are supposed to be riding the buses.
We have a mass arrest. Going to be staging down by the Kingdom. Any change in that? Would you like to move up anywhere else? 232, correction.
232, go ahead.
Yeah, they've just staged at Pike and Boren, so they'll be standing by. If that's good for you, we'll leave them.
Yeah, I was a little confused. I thought we had already covered that, but I thought maybe we had some different buses. Pike and Boren's fine for now. Or Boren's fine.
1030, Who Guards the Guardians, is a radiophonic piece which documents police transmissions, or I should say radio communications, between law enforcement authority, police, sheriffs, so on and so forth, on November 30th, 1999. And on that day, thousands gathered to protest the World Trade Organization. What N30, Who Guards the Guardians, documents is a vanishing or soon-to-vanish soundscape. And that soundscape is that of law enforcement communicating with each other and visually and sonically describing what went on that day. Some of these kinds of recordings, you can buy a police scanner and you can hear some of them, but quite often, and you'll hear hints of this in Who Guards the Guardians, of police saying, call me on my cell phone, meaning that there's something that I do not want archived on the public record. What has happened over the last 15, 20 years is that there have been frequency bands that have been carved up and allocated to police purposes, to supposedly Homeland Security agencies and initiatives that can no longer be picked up by these police scanners, although older police scanners can pick up some of these frequencies, which is why there's a brisk market for these things on eBay, as well as a small movement of folks who open these police scanners up and hot rod them so they can listen to so-called forbidden frequencies. In a way, it humanizes the police, but it also tells us and gives us a sense of how much of a war it can be when people merely decide to gather At no point in N30 Who Guards the Guardians will you hear an exposition of the issues of why people gathered to protest the World Trade Organization. That's actually not what the piece is about. The piece begins, I think, with a very concrete portrayal of what goes on. N30 Who Guards the Guardians fuses official and unofficial recordings of police transmissions made on November 30th, 1999. It's all boiled into a simmering polyglot of radio traffic, polyphonic speech, flashes and sprays of tape hiss, enigmatic numbers, glossolalia, and other broadcast anomalies. N30 is crucial in that there are no names. The characters are the voices themselves. Voices do recur and you will recognize them, but affixing a name to them, as we would say in a traditional drama or novel or story, is not something that's really possible.
07:05.
Adam 1, I'm not calling directly, but they're down at a lower level. I'm up above the street overlooking Union Street, and a protester was just caught trying to climb the fence up here. When left and all, he's being ushered out by one of the venue officers.
07:01.
What's your location? I'll come and see you.
Where you left me, I'm up in the King Union Square overlooking Union Street.
I'll be there in 5 minutes. A couple of demonstrations out there. Could we be advised of the location?
We're being controlled by protesters up here trying to access the area.
The other major one that's going on right now is at Victor Steinbrück Park.
Minutes.
We have any information on activities and size?
Well, I'm looking at the call there, and it doesn't say the size, but they said the CD over there said that one was pretty much under control.
Southbound, under the center at James Street.
I do see now that they say 250 people under control, Victor Steinbeck.
Again, I want to verify for State Patrol. That is northbound, correct, south of the convention center.
Some protesters have
I believe that is affirmative.
Road closure sign.
Trooper underneath
southbound on 6th Avenue at
freeway, or next to the freeway, just south of the vehicle. And the vehicle is not on the freeway, it's on a road.
Frank 314 to Frank 300, there's a small group that just went south. They're going eastbound on University, probably only about 40 in the group, chanting and signs.
And command, this is 744. That group is now northbound on 8th at Seneca.
Demo dev to radio.
Thank you.
Wir trinken uns zusammen und betrunken zum Thema stoßen wir zusammen uns wie Asse. Wenn du etwas für mich übrig hast, dann gib mir bitte den Rest. La, 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 la.
Stop, manifest destiny, rewind. A bullet go back in a gun, rapping in tongues. See me know circular, circular love. N'est pas anglais, no es inglés. It's not English. Ricky tiki tang, ricky tang tang, ricky tiki tang, ricky tiki tang, ricky tiki tang, ricky tang tang, ricky tang, ricky tiki tang. Circumstantial. See me pull my own abstract out the backpack. And I don't even really want that. You can have that. So far, a couple hundred G's for a one letter signature. V, 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 V.
Khrushchev departed from his set speech to reply.
If you like capitalism, and I'm sure that you do, God's with you. Continue in your efforts, but take care. A new system has emerged. A system that is treading, that has started to, treading, that has started to, treading, that has started to, that has started to, tread on your heels. And if at any time you start lagging behind, we will certainly surpass you.
Next, Hyde Park and a visit to the Roosevelt home, and back to New York to make a far-reaching, if vague, proposal to the United Nations Assembly.
Yeah. phone that we have now, what do you?
Back down and back up. And back up again. Back down.